It's time for Sounding Off with Phil Goff.
Morena. Mayor Phil Goff, how are you this morning?
Oh, morena, Rachel. I'm good, thank you very much. Things are busy, but it's kind of fun.
There are some cool things happening around the city. We're going to talk about some of the, I guess, more broader picture stuff, but I thought it'd be nice to start with some stuff that I'm sure plenty of people have seen pop up around town. City of Colours, which is a cool sort of installation or cross-central city series of artworks and cool things happening. It's really nice to see people returning to town. Are we seeing an increase in numbers into the CBD?
Yeah, we certainly are. When we launched City of Colours last week, and I went with a group of people around town looking at the different things. What it's about, for listeners that may not be familiar with it, is that there are 50 illuminated art and lighting installations across the city centre, basically from Karanga Happy Road down to the waterfront, and it runs between the 6th and the 22nd of May, so you've still got time to go out and have a look at it. And what it was designed to do was just to mark the revitalisation of the city centre, which is starting to happen as people return to the city centre. More people are returning to work in the office rather than working from home. Our public transport numbers are up, the numbers coming into the city, the motorways are unfortunately crowded again. It's because the city centre is so important to us. It's 20% of the city's GDP, so it's $5 billion a year, 40,000 people living here, 145,000 in normal times come in to work or study in the city. And City of Colours was a way just to highlight the fact that we want to reinvigorate the city centre and make it what it was pre-COVID and even better. And the really good thing I noticed last week was how many more people were out and about in the city.
Absolutely.
The bars, the restaurants, the cafes, pedestrians, people in the shops. And it was feeling really good, actually, after the fairly dismal, we've been a bit of a ghost town in the centre of town.
Totally.
Over a period of time.
Particularly right down by the viaduct, it's nice to see a lot of that where the construction's been starting to reopen up. I wanted to touch on, you mentioned the transport numbers have been up in Auckland Transport, and they've said that since the introduction of half-price fares, there's been a huge return to public transport, 50% increase in the buses, 66% increase in trains, and 78% increase in ferries. Now, I mean, we've talked about this before. Obviously, the council has a huge deficit at the moment, COVID-related, but this is a pretty good, case for making public transport more accessible financially more of the time. What is going on here? Is this ever going to be a conversation we can have in a long term and not a sort of short stopgap way?
Yeah, no, it is a conversation we can have. But just on the increased numbers, what Auckland Transport tell me is that the effect of the lower, the half price transport fares has probably been about 5 to 10%, rather than their numbers have gone up overall. But that's because people are coming back to work in the city. So you've got to disaggregate, and it's a bit hard to do actually. What the impact of lower fares has been, and the impact of the city coming back to life. But just on the question of lower fares, I mean, obviously we want that, and from 1 July there'll be a permanent 50% discount for people using the community services card. We put that in our last long-term plan and working with government to ensure that happens. So the targeting support to the people who need it most. If I catch public transport into town, I don't need the discount, notwithstanding the fact actually I'm entitled to a gold card, which I, feels a bit odd when people on much lower
income. We have talked about this before though, but when we're talking about climate change and as a city trying to mitigate our emissions and also reduce broadly our car usage across the city, surely having incentives to get even those high income earners into public transport is something we should be focusing on.
Yeah, but what you have to weigh it up against is what is the impact of reducing fares as against the impact of using the equivalent amount of money to improve the frequency and the reach of public transport services. So if you don't have a public transport service, giving free fares isn't going to help. And what we've been doing, here's a good example. On Friday, we opened the extension to the North Busway, and that's you know, over $300 million investment in that, another 5 kilometres. But we know that when, as soon as we made that busway available to people on the shore, we're getting up to over half of the people coming from the shore to the city in peak hours using the bus rather than using their car. And the reason is because it's frequent, it's accessible, it's reliable, it's convenient. And those things actually have more impact than simply reducing the fares. People on, you know, they said people on the North Shore were too affluent to use buses. Well, they generally have got a higher level of income over on the shore, not universally, but they'll use bus services if they're convenient, frequent, and reliable. What we've found in some studies overseas is that where you've reduced bus fares, what you've done in particular is you've persuaded those people that were walking and cycling instead to hop on a bus rather than, you know, than walk or cycle. And what we're trying to do is get new groups of people that were otherwise using their cars to transfer to use buses or trains. So you can only use one lot of money once. So if there's a choice between, say, building an extension to the busway or, you know, building the city rail link or putting in light rail or having free fares, look, ideally you'd do everything, but you don't have enough money to go around, then you've got to make sure you're putting the money where you get the best mode change from.
Okay, well, let's talk about cycling since it was mentioned there. We're seeing a lot of money being put into cycling infrastructure. $306 million already has been allocated, and there is a call for more, up to a $1.7 billion increase to the funding for cycle infrastructure. And this is also including things like education around cycling in schools and bike safety and things like this. Now, how have we got to this point? Because it's been, you know, quite a fraught conversation, particularly in the last 2 years. How have we got to this point now? And what is the path forward from here?
Well, the path forward is partly including what we're doing now. Yesterday morning at 5:30, I was out on Tamaki Drive as we officially opened the Tamaki Drive bus cycle link, which joined up, you know, from the Napipi intersection through to Key Street. Key Street, of course, has got a separated cycle link. In about a fortnight, we're opening stage two of the Glen Innes to Tamaki Drive cycleway, which is totally off-road and will run all the way from Glen Innes through to Tamaki Drive. We've done stage one to St. John's. This will take us from St. John's right through to probably to the end of Napipi Road, and then we've just got that last section to do. So there are things happening there. We've got the $306 million set aside. That's already budgeted for. And what we're doing with our cycleways, and it's really quite important, is how we prioritise it. So the priorities that we adopted in the planning committee the other day was about a connected network, because people, the main reason people don't cycle is they don't feel safe when they're working in and out of the traffic. And I absolutely understand that. So connecting the networks, as we will with the example I just used, Glen Innes through to Tamaki Drive, you'll be able to get from Glen Innes all the way to the city centre without being on the road and mixing with traffic. Secondly, we're looking at those routes that will get the largest number of users. Thirdly, we're looking at where we can use existing road space and convert it to cycleways. That's obviously faster and cheaper to deliver. And fourthly, but not lastly, it's how we can reduce deaths and serious injuries, because we know that 70% of deaths and serious injuries on the road now are not people in cars, they're pedestrians, they're cyclists and they're motorcyclists. So what this meeting last week was about was setting the priorities and setting the goals. But, you know, we've got a strategy. If the money were to be available, we could spend $1.7 billion. At the moment, that money isn't available. It will be the $306 million plus about another $130 million from the climate action targeted rate if councillors adopt my proposal on that in a couple of weeks' time.
Now, when is the decision-making on that?
On the targeted rate?
Yes.
The decision-making will be at the either at the end of May or early June. And my proposal has been backed by the public consultation that we did. Of the public consultation, we got 11,000 submissions, which was a huge amount of submissions for an annual plan. And 68% were for and 27% were against. We also went out and did independent polling. And again, there was a large margin in support, 48% for, 36% against. So the public has told councillors that there is a mandate for this, and now it's a question of councillors having the determination and the courage to make the decision for the targeted rate so that we can get on electric ferries, more cycleways, more walkways, and most particularly, just as we're talking about at the start of the program, about $600 or $700 million going into extending our bus services, more frequent bus services, more outreach to areas not currently covered, particularly those in low-income areas.
When we speak about public consultation as well, there's a neat segue into our last thing to talk about this morning, which we have been discussing in the last month quite a lot because it's a very significant change. Now, this is the Auckland housing intensification conversation that's going on at the moment. Public consultation ended last night. What's the response been from the public? Has there been much feedback?
I haven't got the numbers yet, but I do know from the webinars that we've been holding, we've been getting several hundred people on those, and that's really good for a webinar. The important thing to stress is that a whole lot of the stuff that the government has legislated for, National Policy Statement on Urban Development and the Enabling Housing Supply Amendment to the Resource Management Act, is mandatory. You know, we don't have any choice. Councils have to do what the government has mandated. But there are some exemptions that they've allowed, and one of the points of interest has been, the government saying, and we're generally in favour of intensification, and as long as it's done in a quality way. But they're saying, let's have more of it in the, mm-hmm. the central city area. Well, of course we'll do that. We've got no limit in the city centre. But if we did nothing, what it would mean is that the bulldozers would move in, and some of the legacy heritage housing, the 1900s villas, would be severely affected by that. They're currently called special character areas.
There has been quite a bit of discussion about the special character areas. There's been accusations of it being gerrymandering from the proponents of that particular part of this legislation here. What are the frustrations that we're seeing? We're seeing people concerned that the special character area is too blanket. It's covering swathes of the city where we could be seeing really useful density housing. Where have we got to with what we've touched on in the past, this more sort of targeted, okay, house by house or street by street conversation?
Yeah, well, we have done that work on the ground, enormous amount of work getting council officers out on the street saying, okay, let's look at our special character areas. Let's get it in context. First of all, it's 3.5% of all of our housing. It's about 21,000 houses. And what we're doing, as we're required to do under law, is to go through that and say, are all of those special character areas worthy of protection against intensification? And what our officers are basically telling us is that about 70% on close examination, both by Google and actually on the street, about 70% of it is likely to be put forward for protection. Now, some people say not enough, you need to protect 100%. Well, we'd lose if we tried to protect 100%. Others are saying you're protecting far too much. We should bulldoze the heritage and just put the intensification in the areas close to the city centre. Like most things, it'll be finding the happy medium. It'll be finding a compromise which we know will work. And we think we've got that. Part of the consultation was to get the feedback from the public, and just to collate what their thinking is, and we'll probably go both ways.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Mayor Phil Gough.
Okay.
I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you next week.
No problem.
Ka kite.
Ma te wa.
That was Sounding Off with Phil Gough.
Thank you.